The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, welcome back. Among the many great things about being at the law school is that both at the law school and the set of faculty, we mix our scholarship and academic real world and being part of the issues that shape our time. And we're very fortunate at the law school to have two people within the UN system who are leading related efforts on the international response to torture. And we thought that it would be an interesting opportunity, since we have both of them with us on the faculty, to have a bit of a conversation about that and to highlight their work. You've met Dean Grossman, the dean. In this session, he's not only the dean, but also speaking with respect to his term as the chair of the United Nations Committee Against Torture. He's been on the committee since 2003, and he was anonymously elected to be chair in 2008 and re-elected in 2011 to be the chair of the United Committee Against Torture. I don't actually know, maybe we can ask him how he finds the time to do all the things he does, but that could be part of the question. We're also very privileged as a faculty to have Juan Mendez as a professor here at the law school. And since November of 2010, Professor Mendez has been the UN Special Rapporteur on torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatments for punishment. He's also served as a Special Advisor on Prevention for the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. He's the co-chair of the Human Rights Institute of the International Bar Association. And I also, with all due respect to Ms. Beltran, who's our first graduate, graduating class in 1992, I just learned that Professor Mendez was a prototype for the program. He attended the law school at a time when we didn't have an LLM program, on a program that was designed for foreign lawyers to prepare for taking the bar. So he was only 4 years old at the time, very young, he actually had his prototype. So the way we thought we would run this session is start with a few minutes, no more than 10 from each of the participants, to discuss their mandate and their work, and then we'll have a discussion, hopefully, for questions from you and from us, from me. So we'll start with Professor Mendez.
Thank you very much, David. And thanks for the reminder. It's been a long time, but it has been my privilege to study here and now to teach here. So I'm very honored to be invited to celebrate with you this 30 years of extraordinary achievements, and not only with you, David, and with you, Claudio, but also with many of you who have in the past and in the present making contributions as students of the ILSP. And congratulations to all of you as well. The United Nations has basically three or four different mechanisms on torture, which, you know, is an illustration of the unique nature of torture as a human rights violation in many ways, but also the interest of the international community in trying to achieve some effectiveness in combating it. It is the Committee Against Torture that Claudio chairs and is going to talk about. There is a subcommittee on the prevention of torture created by the optional protocol to the convention, and that has a subcommittee that does prison visits. And there's the special rapporteurship on torture, which I occupy right now. There's also a committee that has a fund for the victims of torture that, in a way, you know, is also a mechanism for rehabilitation and redress, but also a preventive mechanism of sorts as well. All of those are part of the United Nations, and of course regional bodies have themselves experimented with many different ways of dealing with torture and trying to prevent it and to abolish it in our time. The special rapporteurship on torture is one of the so-called special procedures, which means it's not a treaty body, so the disadvantage with respect to the treaty bodies like the Committee Against Torture is that the special procedures are undoubtedly non-binding. You know, whatever we say may have some weight or not, but as a matter of law, states are not obligated to follow. Obviously, when we do make damning statements about a state's behavior with respect to torture, we are based on binding norms. Not only the norms in the Convention Against Torture and in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but even on customary international law standards and even jus cogens standards. But the fact that we say it is not by itself binding. The upside of that is that we have a jurisdiction over all member states of the United Nations, 193 or 94 maybe at last count, which does give us a big advantage, obviously, over treaty bodies because they have jurisdiction mostly, as will be explained, over state parties to the respective conventions. The special procedures were created originally by the Commission on Human Rights of the United Nations, now replaced by the Human Rights Council. There was a time when there was an attempt to abolish all of them and start over, but fortunately they have been kept and retained by the Human Rights Council, and I think right now they enjoy quite a bit of standing, if you will, at the Human Rights Council. And among them, the Special Rapporteurship on Torture is one of the older ones. It was created back in 1985, it was occupied before me by four very distinguished European jurists. That really blazed a trail as to how to make the most effective use of this mechanism. Nowadays, all special procedures are more or less regulated and unified in the way they do their work. In terms of mandate, I won't go into detail because it's very much the same mandate as the committee. But essentially, what one has to remember is that the mandate extends not only to torture, but also to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And as you know, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment can result from objective conditions. There doesn't need to be an intent to inflict severe pain and suffering. And so the mandate becomes very, very broad because in practice it does include, for example, prison conditions. My predecessor, Manfred Nowak, insisted on visiting prison conditions, and of course I've continued continued with that practice whenever I go to a country. But in addition, we have kind of pushed the envelope of the mandate to deal with conditions forms of treatment of people in other custodial situations, like in mental hospitals, on juvenile homes, etc., as long as they are there and cannot leave, and the conditions raise concerns about torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. But even in non-custodial situations. For example, in the context of the Arab Spring, I have had many occasions of sending communications to different governments on the excessive use of force that resulted in excessive pain and suffering in demonstrations in the street. Even though the person was never arrested, the treatment was such that at least in principle violated the standard of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. But beyond the mandate, all of the special procedures have basically three methodologies that we apply. One is the individual case mechanism by which we receive from the public, from anybody, human rights organizations, but also victims themselves, requests for interventions, and we engage in a system of communications with the territorial state, the state involved, and try to elucidate the truth or veracity of the allegations that we receive. We call those allegation letters, and in the case of urgent actions, we call them urgent actions, and in the allegations letters, we give the government 60 days, but of course in urgent actions, we don't give them any time. We ask for an immediate response. Unfortunately, the procedure is very, very rudimentary, to say the least. It's basically an exchange of notes, and sometimes not even an exchange, because many states don't even answer. So we try to ascertain the facts, and then at some point, at least in the early stages, the procedure is confidential. We cannot share with the public what we are discussing with the state, but when the state responds and we reach a conclusion, we made this public and we submit a report on each case to the Human Rights Council for discussion at the council, and at that point the communication, the response of the state, and my conclusions, if any, become part of the public record. The second methodology is country visits, and we call them fact-finding missions. Governments prefer to call them country visits, but the fact is that they are a full-fledged, very intense way of visiting a country and trying to learn everything that can be learned about the practice of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and particularly with a view to giving states some suggestions as to how to curb practices that may be negative. And in that case, in that sense, I visited in about less than 2 years, I visited Tunisia, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Morocco and Western Sahara. And for the first three, there are already reports. Obviously, Morocco is very recent, so there will be a report on it later on. And then the third methodology is what we call thematic reports. On the occasion of a report, I have to report once a year to the Human Rights Council and once a year to the General Assembly. So that gives me a chance twice a year to elaborate on some issue within the matter of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment that I think should deserve some more attention from the states. And I try to choose areas that are not well explored or where the international standards are at least ambiguous so that we can generate a discussion. I have to say that the discussions are not all that encouraging because they take place once a year in each body, and there's 140 countries trying to intervene, so you have a couple of minutes each. And some of them have read the report, some have not. So we cannot say that we have a rich discussion. But the fact that it's a discussion and that the documents are public gives us a chance to generate attention to the particular issue and with the help of civil society organizations to generate more attention. So so far I have dealt with solitary confinement, with commissions of inquiry, and in my next report in a couple of weeks to the General Assembly with capital punishment and the extent to which capital punishment may or may not infringe the prohibition of torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And then we are, for my March 2013 report to the Council, we hope to be able to write a report on torture, including human and degrading treatment in healthcare settings. As you can see, these are areas where we push the envelope of, because the definitions of torture in the international law are relatively restrictive. You know, torture has to be performed by a state agent, and it has to be performed with intent to create to inflict pain and suffering of a certain severity. So we're not going to violate those restricting standards, but we are going to find state action, for example, in a variety of situations in which the state is at least aware of practices and or has a duty to regulate practices that may be conducted by private actors, and therefore the state has a responsibility. Within those parameters, the main purpose of these thematic reports is, as I said, to generate a discussion and hopefully to join campaigning organizations that can use the position of this of the special rapporteur on torture for their campaigning and advocacy purposes. I'll stop here and listen to Claudio now. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor.
Well, thank you again, David, for the invitation, and I'm pleased also to be here in your company and the company of Juan Mendez, the Special Rapporteur on torture. The Committee Against Torture is a treaty body created by the Convention Against Torture. The Convention Against Torture, basically, there are other things. It does two things. One, it establishes obligations related to torture. It defines terms that are relevant for the struggle against torture, and then it creates a machinery for supervision and techniques of supervision. What are the obligations that come out from the Convention Against Torture? First of all, to incorporate internally the definition of torture, or more than a definition, the criteria that allow us to consider behavior torture. This is in the Article 1 of the Convention that includes severe suffering, emotional or physical. Severe suffering for individuals intentionally inflicted, done for a series of purposes, and basically every purpose that is politically relevant is included: to extract information, to punish, or for any other discriminatory purpose, done by under the color of authority, meaning it should be a state agents, or with the acquiescence of a state agent. The definition of torture is important because it has provided the intellectual arguments and to individuals and organizations that oppose the more restrictive interpretations of what's torture. In the United States, I mean, you heard about the memo, the Gonzales memos, that basically stated that torture was only that severe inflicted intentional punishment that resulted in death or in organ failure. Well, that is an absolute restriction of the concept of torture. That means that if you waterboard people or you take the nails of people, that's not torture. Well, again, Article 1 embodied the customary definition of torture that includes the elements that I mentioned before. And that's an important thing, because then you have the arguments of a treaty, approve obligations to, and you can ask for its application. Other important article of, all the articles are important, but in this context I want to mention the fact that torture is a non-derogable right. the prohibition against torture, or it's a non-deroga, or you cannot claim national security, the emergency, or whatever. This is a non-deroga. This is what states have done. They ratified this. You and I didn't do it. So when some people are asking the application of torture and or government officials say that, they are violating their own obligations. We can talk more why this is, in other words, this non-derogability is realistic. I mean, it's in academia or in politics, sometimes people come out with the hypotheticals. You know, wouldn't you torture someone if the survival of civilization would depend on extracting information? All these type of things that are the typical, I would say, for academic circles and also for political purposes. But torture doesn't live in that domain. We have not. The millions of human beings who have been tortured have not been tortured because they are atomic terrorists. I mean, so all this has a political purpose, is to lower the threshold. And again, that hypotheticals in reality. Again, I mean, I read, and I want to mention this, I read something very convincing. If there is an atomic terrorist, first of all, how do you know that in advance? Everyone is potentially an atomic terrorist, right? So there is a tremendous liberty. You don't know until you get a confession. Second thing, if that type of terrorist would, and terrorism is bad, there is no just cause for terrorism, that terrorist will be prepared for this type of situation. And there would be false leads and so forth and so on, because the whole thing is the ticking bomb, immediately will exploit, wouldn't you touch? Well, the terrorists adopt the measures that will avoid the being detected through torture, I mean, and the ticking bomb immediately. But again, these are hypothetical things, and we have not seen even arguments in that direction reflecting a practice. The second thing, if you are totally innocent, you have more chances to be tortured more brutally, because the terrorist can say something, or a sympathizer perhaps can give some leads, but the person who is absolute innocent cannot say anything, and we have cases involving it. The ones who are tortured, so we're all in danger when we soften this prohibition against torture. I assume that you, like me, are not involved in bad things, and that's why I say all of us are in danger. Then, other obligations of the convention include the provision of non-refoulement, not sending people to countries where there are it's likely that they will be tortured. And it's also an important principles of civilization. There are other obligations. You cannot use torture under for judicial procedures as a convention. There are obligations to investigate and punish, severe penalties, training, and so forth and so on. You see, it's an important conquest of civilization to establish at the international level this. The convention not only prohibits torture, but other forms of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment and punishment. It requires also, when torture takes place, in addition to investigation and punishment, reparation, rehabilitation, when possible, and so forth and so on. We're engaged now in drafting an interpretation on the convention on what is exactly reparation, and it's going to be adopted now in November. And I think that will be a very important contribution to give guidance to states, victims, and so forth and so on, to provide full relief when torture takes place. Systems of supervision. First of all, 152 countries have ratified this convention. Only 61 have accepted the system of individual petitions, meaning individuals that can come and complain, arguing that their rights have been violated. Because most of the countries in the beginning who accepted this were countries that were not engaged in systematic torture, the Western European countries and so forth and so on, most of the cases we have had concern alleged violations of, or potential violations of Article 3, meaning non-refoulement. I am going to be sent to a country where it is likely that I will be tortured. We have had some cases, however, now increased ratification and so forth of torture or involving countries. Example, Serbia, Montenegro, former Yugoslavia, and so forth and so on, Czech Republic. They almost all concern gypsies. It's a really awful situation of discrimination. I mean, it's if you see a percentage of people in jail, the brutality and so forth, actions against gypsies is interesting. It's installed. I've seen this in the minds of people that gypsies are criminals. I mean, this is installed in the minds of. And then if a gypsy is running in the street, he stole something. If a non-gypsy is running on the street, he's jogging. But if it is a gypsy, he stole something. So we see many cases of abuse in this area, and we're concerned about it, and it's rooted on discrimination. Well, that's Article 3. The good news with Article 3 is that there is almost 100% compliance with our decisions. And I think that's a great thing, and it's very valuable. The core supervisory function of the committees is the country reports every 4 years, where the country has to present a report showing the status of compliance with the convention. Then we listen to NGOs in writing and verbally. Then we engage the countries in a dialogue. They send almost always very high delegation, high-level delegations, including members of cabinets and so forth and so on. And as a result of this dialogue, that sometimes is described as constructive dialogue, and sometimes is everything but constructive, I would say. But the dialogue results in the in concluding observations by the committee. And the concluding observations are two types. One, that some type of concluding observation, usually three or four, that we expect that be implemented within a year and reported within a year. We have a system of follow-up. That sends questions and so forth, and reminds about this and comments on the responses by government. Everything is on the web also. The comments by NGOs, the responses by the countries, in the both in the dialogue and the communication that we receive in advance and afterwards. We think transparency is very important. All the things have been fought and continue to be fought. Some countries resist the webcasting, and again, international law is the mobilization of shame and so forth. And then the idea is very different when you have a dialogue with a member state or a state party, and that is in the web in real time. You know, so that creates an absolute different dynamic. And I have insisted as a chair that the system is public, the hearings are public, and if it is public, we're not going to be prohibiting webcasting or other type of devices. This is a public exchange of it. The concluding observations have played an important role in many countries. Now, again, there is no army that will enforce the concluding observation, but there are reasons why in many situations they have assisted governments in the formulation of public policies. First of all, the governments are not they cannot be captured by the word enemy. I mean, the governments are the enemy. You have delegations of people that play a role of going there. Of going back to a country and saying that we need to modify this and that. The same governments created these mechanisms that allow even inhabitants to go against them. We have within the government delegation, I mean, individuals that support the realization of human rights. There is a paradigm by Allison that is called the one rational actor. A government is not one rational actor that makes a decision. You have different agencies, different groups, different individuals. So that dialogue I have seen results in modification and has the potential to affect change. Second thing, depending on the political situation in the country, the opposition captures something. Different lobby groups, different NGOs, and so forth, and they move for the adoption of the recommendations done by the committee. We have then recommendations within a year, and recommendations that apply for the period, for the longer period. I think it's interesting for you, if you have a really further curiosity on this, to get into the website of the committee and look at a country that you are interested in and see the recommendations and the follow-up and the NGO shadow report. This system has saved lives, has resulted in the modification of state policies and provided the collective experience of treaty bodies to assist the governments in the modification of policies involving issues involving gender or discrimination or training, and I can go on and on. We don't have time of this. We cannot say, however, that we have less torture in the world. However, in my opinion, what we need to do is to continue to think to achieve how we achieve that goal, because again the situation in the jails is very dramatic in many countries. Juan has issued a report on isolation. I mean, and what happens with that. But I don't think we have another alternative that continues to push and to talk and demand and mobilize. The role of civil society is also essential. I mean, this is a tremendous resource for the states, a source of information, expertise, and whatever we do, we need to keep an eye on that, how we strengthen internally. We have also developed other mechanisms, like the optional protocol that Juan mentioned, because we are outside, and then we connect, we dialogue cases and so forth. But the optional protocol created a system of supervision that includes the development of the national mechanism with the ability to go any place and announce. So that's a further normative development that contributes to the prevention of torture. International law continues to be essential. Listen, in how many democracies can you run for election and say, for example, if I win, I will use resources to build good jails? If you do that, you lose the election. Huh? And a lot of violation of human rights take place in close environments, including jails. So the role of international law and these organs is essential then to achieve. And people think short term, because if you tell them, well, it's better for your own security to have jails that are humane and create possibility of rehabilitation, I mean, that unfortunately we have not seen the domestic system being very successful in convincing people of that goal. So there is where international law play a role, and international law with independent experts that do not act on the basis of political instruction. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for that, and it left me with before I open it up to other questions, a couple of questions, and one that kind of is particularly interested for me in the environmental area. If I understand this, we have both a system that's based on a treaty and rooted in the treaty, and one that's based in more soft law norms, although some hard law norms, but not treaty-based. And I'm wondering, I have two questions related to this. One, does it allow for cooperation between your two offices? I'm sitting in between you, but I'm hopeful that there's integration before that. And moreover, is there a sense that the response of states is stronger in the committee because it's a system of binding, and also that they've acceded to it in the treaty form? I got the impression that you're more frustrated with the state's response, And you feel, and this may not be right, that perhaps because of the treaty system, the states are more able to respond, or certainly you said you had compliance with respect to at least some aspects of it. But both of you also emphasize the importance of the role of sort of civil society and transparency in NGOs. So I'm just wondering if you feel a difference because of the different structures, and also how you coordinate. And I'll give it to you, Mr. Mendez, first.
There are some states that respond to this rapporteurship very thoroughly and very promptly. The thing is, because we cover 194 countries, the percentage of states that don't take us seriously obviously has to be larger than for the CAT. I also feel that the fact that they're not obliged by a treaty commitment also plays a role in that. Nevertheless, as I said, we do get some positive response and some success. I think it's important to have both, a treaty body that can that will be listened to because of treaty commitments of solemn obligations acquired by states, but also a body like the rapporteurship that can reach out even to those countries that are that simply won't sign and ratify treaties. And as I said, and you pointed out, David, the substantive basis of the obligations that we try to hold to states to are unmistakably binding. It's my recommendations may not be binding, but if I find a violation, I find a violation of a jus cogens norms, a prohibition on torture. I mean, that's the most widely accepted jus cogens norms as an imperative norm that no state can depart from.
In the struggle against torture, the organs that we have developed perform a different function. I mean, the ultimate goal is the same. The role of Juan Mendez here is flexible, day-to-day, ¿cómo se dice ágil? With the ability to respond immediately to an issue. So somebody's been told, goes to Juan Mendez, he issues something, appeals, and that's very important because, and it's crucial. It's crucial. I mean, the special mandates, this is what, have an ability that the treaty boys do not have. Because you are regulated with a more heavy machinery. So the ability to bring to attention of international community some issues and push the envelope and to react concerning concrete violations. I mean, that's the role of special procedures. Of course, when they are dealing with the worst cases and situations, the rate of compliance will not be the same, and this country will not ratify a treaty either, so it's not a question of a lost opportunity. We have 152 countries that have ratified this treaty, meaning 40 have not ratified, and one of the out of the 152, only 61 have accepted our system of petitions. So it's a self-selected group. Like, we know that there is a difference in evaluation when you have a compulsory class, 100 students go there, than when you have a seminar with people that went there because they liked the seminar. So he has the compulsory class, but only with the bad students. Because, I mean, that does not mean the only, but the tough situation, the tough situation. Countries that have not accepted 61, for example, have not ratified the optional protocol or the convention. So, of course, it's going to be more, the rate of compliance will not be the same. Now, I also would like to say this. Article 6, I mean, the right, I was talking about the right of individual petition. And then on the general reporting, that is like accompanying states in the compliance of their obligations, formulating general recommendations that assist them in compliance with their obligation. For example, don't use tasers. I mean, to deport the people, train individuals, incorporate definitions. So it's a public policy. And there, the rate of compliance is not 100%, far from. But we see movements ahead. We have recommended ratification of the optional protocol. This preventive mechanism created internally. Some countries have done that. Ratification of the International Criminal Court statute. So we have a more mixed situation. But certainly, it's a more self-selected group when you have ratified something. That does not mean that we don't have big violators, because we do. That they're in no compliance, they don't cooperate with the follow-up procedure, and so forth and so on.
You asked also about cooperation between the organs, and there's, of course, quite extensive cooperation. For example, in a country report, I will use standards developed by the committee to understand a certain provision of the but I will also recommend that the state implement recommendations by the committee and of the subcommittee, and I will also urge them to adapt legislation to what the committee has said is the proper way to implement. But those are the kinds of easy forms of cooperation. We are trying to do something a little more systematic, and so we meet regularly and we try to cooperate. But being willing to cooperate and being ready to cooperate is not the same as cooperating. To be quite fair, quite frank, it's not that easy. We're all very busy people. We're all doing our own thing. It's difficult to coordinate any further than that. But we have, for example, exchanged views on how to follow up, because that's the real challenge at the United Nations is, you know, even if we have these marvelous recommendations, how do we know when we move on to the next state that, in fact, these recommendations are taken seriously, are being implemented or not? And just an effort at follow-up is also a little beyond our reach in terms of resources and time and energy and all that. So trying to come up with smart ways of following up is something that we are discussing.
Right. One thing that we have achieved also, the 23rd of this month, Juan and I are reporting to the General Assembly of the United Nations, and symbolically, and also the chair of the OPCA, the optional protocol. That's what I mentioned, is supervised prevention and so on. And then we will have a joint press conference at 1:15, the 23rd. Also, when the international community see, I mean, symbols play a role. That are and see the three organs on the struggle against torture together, and so that creates also weight, because legitimacy is a function also of some coherence. Looking at the. That people going in a certain direction. Now, symbols are not the only thing, but it also matters. Good.
I don't know if there are any questions from the audience. I have a... Oops, turned it off. If there are any questions from the audience. Yeah, Yuri?
Yuri Alexander Romagna. I did my LLM here. I graduated in May. I'm from Colombia. My question is for Professor Mendes. Professor Mendes, what are the major challenges that you have found to carry out your mandate? And also, like, what are the patterns of a specific violation of, for example, committing torture in jail, for example? Like, what are the patterns that you have found across different countries? Like, what types of specific violation you find in common in those countries?
Thank you, Yuri. Well, I think the one, you know, persistent problem that we face everywhere is that the very clear international standard that every act of torture has to be investigated, prosecuted, and punished is the one that the states have the most difficulty in establishing. I mean, there's a sense of impunity that is sometimes very rationally and very deliberately imposed by covering up acts of torture, by not investigating, and even by putting obstacles in investigations by independent agencies of the state. But you know, this lack of accountability is it seems to be something that you see across cultures, across geography, just about everywhere. And getting states to take seriously the obligation to investigate, prosecute, and punish is very hard. There's also other aspects that also are not easily met, like, for example, the obligation to exclude from evidence any statement obtained under torture. It's very easy for states to ignore it by simply saying, well, the victim has to prove that he has been tortured. And of course, you know, the police waits a few days, and then it's very easy to prove the allegation of torture. Very difficult, I mean, to prove the allegation of torture, and the state doesn't put any effort in seriously proving it, and therefore confessions obtained under torture and statements against others obtained under torture do find their way into judicial cases. But I would say finally that the largest obstacle that I see is one a cultural one. I think 10 years ago, before the war on terror, I feel that we had much more of an agreement among peoples, among cultures, among societies, that torture was evil and that we needed to get rid of it. And I feel that the culture, maybe Hollywood or whatever, has more or less conditioned us to be a little more tolerant of torture. And I believe that you know, that's not something that's definite or permanent. We can change it, but we need to change it, because without the pressure from the public opinion, without the common man and woman saying, you can't do this in my name, you can't inflict this kind of cruelty and say that you're protecting me, you can't do it. It diminishes you, it diminishes the state, it diminishes us as citizens of the state, and it diminishes the members of the agencies that are asked to, you know, engage in this inhumanity. And unless we have this, you know, renewed condemnation, moral first, but also legal and political, the task of abolishing culture in our, torture in our time is made much more difficult.
Something that we have seen, and that's our collective experience. You know, many individuals believe that they are not going to get ill, they're not going to have traffic accidents. I mean, and perhaps it's a condition to survive, because we are exposed to our own fragility, huh? If we are thinking, oh, well, all the dangerous things that could happen, people will not get out to the streets and so forth and so on. And in this matter, what we have seen in this supervisory organ is a lot of cases involving individuals who didn't have anything to do with anything that had torture. When there is tolerance for torture, this affects other people. Huh? And then, building on what one said, I think it's very important to know that when we're talking about torture, it's not something that could happen only to other people, as when we think that cancer is something that can happen only to others. It's not the, not what we have seen. And what we have seen is that the protection of rights, and if I can use the good people that have never done anything wrong in their life, depends on the way we treat the worst human beings on planet Earth. Because if we create bureaucracies with double zero powers, they don't restrict themselves from whatever source. Violent individuals are attracted to the performance of enforcement function. The technological enforcement agencies is restricted, and we see a lot of problems. So without exaggerating here, I think, in the cultural struggle here to exclude this type of behavior is very important for people to know that this is not something we do to others, and that individuals are in danger when we accept torture.
And introduce yourself. It's on.
Okay, so I'm Lauren Bartlett. I work with the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law here at the law school. I'm also a graduate of the law school. I'm wondering about best practices in terms of your mandate as a committee making recommendations, and then civil society. What have you seen in terms of civil society taking those recommendations and getting them enforced?
Well, as the dean said, the intervention of civil society is crucial. We kind of depend on civil society to take our recommendations and our reports and run with them, because we just don't have the capacity to keep insisting on them. And the states have a lot of ways of ignoring us. But the question as to how effectively they do that really depends country by country. There are, in almost every country, there's at least some elements of civil society that are effective and that know how to do this work well, that are sophisticated. But the degree of sophistication and their effectiveness varies widely from country to country. And I would say in many cases it varies widely from moments in the history of each country, because in Latin America we saw, for example, at the end of the cycle of dictatorships, where some countries basically lost their capacity to control the state and establish what some people call vertical accountability. And others adapted very well to the fact that we now have democracies and more space and more ability to influence different actors. So even in Latin America, it varied widely. In some countries, the civil society became very adept at using every aspect of democracy for the benefit of human rights. And in others, they needed a period of adjustment because they had, been accustomed to fighting dictatorship, and the change was not that easy. I see the same in the different countries that I have been visiting. It varies not only from country to country, but from moment to moment in the history of the country, of each country. But it does become a good practice that is emulated, and it's part of our role to not only to hold countries all to the same standards, but also to highlight good practices, not only governmental but also societal good practices that others can then pick up and try to adapt to their own circumstances.
I think that your question is very important, could do for a good law review article, in the sense comparing different things, what functions, follow up, and so on. The treaty boys have not done that, but what's my experience here? A, when we see a situation where, for example, the government is in a permanent dialogue with civil society, and for example, in the preparation of the report that is every 4 years, involve civil society, because that means, when we're talking real things, being open to an exchange. And I think that is very smart also, because the civil societies are going to produce reports. I don't like the word shadow report. It's things that are in the shadow, we don't know. So I refuse to use the expression shadow. There's reports by civil society. But they are going to produce the reports. In today's world, civil society will do that. And then it's intelligent then, instead of learning what the civil society, because they are responding to your question, to create a system of consultation internally. Now, consultation is for real. We live in a world also where you don't fool people. And you know as a government that you can do certain things, other things you cannot do. But again, I think it's, you don't want to be surprised. You can do certain things even before you are in the committee. So I think a good practice is when we see countries where the preparation of the report sent to a committee has been the result of a dialogue with civil society. That doesn't mean that everyone plays a role. Civil society needs to push the envelope. There are different things, but already that's a plus point. We have done this in the process of consultation. Second thing, when in the follow-up, the process of consultation continue. There are NGOs, different people, and so forth, but the NGOs are an important source of expertise and knowledge to assist governments in compliance with their obligations. So when also there is a system of follow-up with participation of civil society, that's a plus point, and so forth. So I think that these are... again, we're not talking about concrete situation, but I think the presence of this anticipates good results. Now, as to substance, I have seen movement ahead on matters involving gender, for example, in the recommendation of the committee. Disability. I mean, one important thing that has emerged has been in the area of disability. I've seen also governments using our concluding observations to push for more resources for jails. Because as I said before, it's not popular. Let us build jails. So the fact that the committee is tortured, blah, 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 I mean, that plays a role, and there are instances where that happens. Treaty ratification also. And again, also, if you go into CAT, I think we use the following system into the website. We put in the beginning of the concluding observations, remember, every 4 years, you know this very well, we were together in Geneva on the CAT session, we start the concluding observations mentioning positive things that have happened. Ratification, matters in political initiatives, and so forth and so on. And we don't do that lightly, because imagine if you say something is positive, we are supervised as well. But that shows you things that have happened in a country. And I think that there is a correlation between positive things that have happened and these instances of dialogue that exist with civil society internally in a country.
Thank you. I have one more question, and it's just shifting it a little bit to being part of the school and how the work that you do in these different atmospheres. How does that integrate with being part of the school? Are they supportive? Are they integrative? And just very briefly, how does this being part of the academic community here shape the work you do there and vice versa, shape and support, and vice versa, how does the work there inform what you do back here? Very briefly.
The special rapporteurships are volunteer, and so you have to have a day job, they're supported by really skeletal staff in Geneva, and I think all of them, but especially mine, is a very demanding job. We literally do half of all the communications done by all the other special rapporteurs, special procedures, and there are 40 of them. And half of all the ones done in a year are done by the rapporteurship on torture. It's very much in demand. There's lots of requests for all kinds of things. So, having as a day job a teaching job in a law school is wonderful. On the one hand, because especially when there's very goodwill like there is here, there's a lot of flexibility that one can incorporate into the work without prejudice to the duties that one has to teach every semester, but also because the students, especially in a law school like this one, are eager to help. In fact, I get many more offers of cooperation that I can ever really use, because quite frankly, you know, you also have to coordinate and organize that cooperation, and it's not that easy. But in my case, the fact that that I now am, for example, this semester I'm co-teaching with someone else, so I don't have to worry too much about lost classes and having to make them up and forcing my students to come on Saturdays and things like that. But also the fact that the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law has a couple of programs to support the work of the rapporteurship, I think gives them great opportunities to do advocacy work, but they facilitate my work enormously. And, you know, we have been able, I think, to supplement the, as I said already, very, you know, very, very insufficient support that we get from Geneva with an excellent team that is working with me here on a daily basis. And I think, the only way to do this job with some prospects of success.
Well, let me say first that I'm the best prepared member of the Committee Against Torture thanks to the students of this institution. Because I teach here a seminar in the fall and on the Committee Against Torture. The students get countries and they work in formulating questions that I ask to the countries as a member of CAT, and also the concluding observations. So no committee member can read everything, but I, and in the formulation of questions, nor me, but the fact that the 10 students that participate in the seminar and doing the reading, exploring, I mean, we sit down, strategize, discuss, and so on, makes me perhaps, if not the most prepared member, one of the most prepared members of the committee. Second thing, 10 students go with me to Geneva. With the 10 students participate in the meeting, strategize, think. I mean, together we decide the questions to ask, things to do. I mean, there are certain ways you ask a question. You cannot be in CAT and say, hey, you liar, how do you dare to say this in the press? No. I mean, there is a traditional language. One expression of that is this constructive dialogue, welcome, warm welcome. Sometimes you are extending a warm welcome to countries that do not deserve that type of. But you do it. There is a diplomatic language there. And then, again, the preparation essential. Then we organize here in the school usually one conference at least per year on this topic, and we have done it with NGOs that participate in the Committee Against Torture. So with the 10 students plus the conference, we are able to present this work for the whole law school. And the human rights brief, the last issue of the human rights brief has one of the conferences on torture. So that multiplies the knowledge. Also, the human rights brief has, 60 students that work there. So presents the work of the law school. So it's a whole, it's an impact. I repent always, I've said this on the seminar we have in Geneva, that I can take only 10 students. We got a grant. Why there are 80, 70 that apply, but we cannot do it even if we were to have the resources, because we cannot get into a committee against torture with 60 students. But now that webcast is possible, we're webcasting some things and we're going to use it as educational material. So you see the whole impact for people. Now, for the people who participate in this activity, this is a unique place. First of all, to work with Juan Mendez, the special rapporteur on torture, and he involves students in the things he does and attracts grants to the law school. That makes this possible. Or to work with me on this matter, this is unique. There is no other law school that offer that possibility in these fields, and that creates certainly a unique place.
Thank you, and thank you, Juan and Claudio, for this discussion. I want to give a little alert of what comes next. I think it's lunch, and I think it's right outside. You can bring it back in here or eat around out there. We're going to reconvene in probably around 12:30 to discuss and to showcase something we're very excited about here, the new building, and to show you a little bit about what the new building will look like, and also to talk a little bit about some of the developments in the program and the show you the new ILSP video. So it's a time to grab lunch, talk to each other, and we'll reconvene back here at about 12:30. Okay. Thank you.